Welcome to the Andy Social Podcast. My name is Andy, and a big hello and welcome to all the new listeners that are tuning in for the first time, and a big welcome back to me mates that always listen every single episode from near and far. No chit-chat for this intro. I'm going to dive straight into it. Well, there'll be a little bit of chit-chat. This episode is a cracker of an episode, and I don't use cracker often as a term. In fact, I feel a little bit silly using that word, so I probably will never use that word again. But it does somewhat describe my feelings around this episode. It is a great one. It features a guy by the name of Arjun Shenoy. And all my mates from India who are probably laughing at my pronunciation of his name. But Arjun is a really, really cool guy I've known for many, many years. In fact, I don't know exactly how long I've known him, but I would say at least 15 years. We both used to chat on the Metal Rules forum back in the day. So any metal fans would probably be well aware of that website. And a lot of us, when we were teenagers, would all jump on there and chat to each other. And it was a great window into a new world of like-minded people that were listening to heavy music. And I built a lot of long-term friendships with people in Australia or all across the country and internationally as well. And I've been lucky enough to bump into people over the years in my travels and still, you know, right up until now, continue to interact and talk to all these people and stay in touch. And it's just it blows your mind that the internet, well, it shouldn't blow your mind anymore, but it blows my mind that going back to that time where I was an angry young teenage boy listening to metal, that I'd formed these great friendships with people all over the world for many, many years. So I reached out to Arjun, but the main reason I did for this episode is that Arjun is a pilot for Air India. So I don't know many pilots. In fact, I think Arjun might be the only pilot that I know, at least commercial pilot off the top of my head. But anyway, the majority of this episode is talking about him in aviation, him working for Air India and being a commander, a captain. And it sounds like one hell of a job. It just, I think for many people that are listening to this episode will be amazed at some of the things we talk about. It's just an incredible thing, and what a job to have. I certainly couldn't do that for the amount of responsibility that sits on his shoulders and anybody else that's a commercial pilot. It's high pressure. It's really high pressure, and I've got a lot of respect for what he does, and he's been doing it for 10 years, and it looks like many years to come for him as well. So enough rambling on. I'll jump straight into the episode. I'll chat a bit at the end of it, and anything that we mention in here will be on the show notes at andysocial.net. So please enjoy my conversation with Arjun Shenoy. Thanks, guys. So I think the first thing, and this might be a great way to kick it off, can you tell me about the person that was on your plane that you were telling me about earlier on a few hours ago, about the guy who was drunk?
Yeah, so yesterday I went to this place called Jaipur, and I was coming back to Mumbai, and the flight was pretty much ready, and just out of the blue, one of the air hostesses, she barged into the cockpit, and she was like really agitated. And she was saying that there's this guy who's completely drunk, and he could barely walk, and he was just trying to like fall over, he tried to fall over her. And so then he was with a couple of other guys. One of them was sober, and the other guy was also drunk, but this guy was like completely plastered. So I asked her, what do you want to do? Do you want to like kick him off the plane? So then they, the crew at the back, they, I told them to like put the fear of God in him and tell him that, you know, if he gets kicked off the plane, he's going to jail and shit like that. And those guys got pretty scared, so they said that they'll behave. But then what happened was the guy who was pissed drunk went to the loo and he pissed all over the place. And then he came back to his seat and he puked all over himself and on the seat. So then it became really yucky. So we had to call the cleaners. They had to clean the loo. They had to clean up the seat. And the guy's friend who was with him, who was also a bit drunk, he was acting smart with the air hostesses, saying that, you know, when they were scolding him or whatever, he said that, you know, you shouldn't talk to me like that. I pay for your salaries. And that's what really pissed her off.
Okay.
That happened. And finally, they decided that they would, you know, they wouldn't throw these guys off the plane. Because the guy who was like drunk was like he just passed out, and the other two were just told to just shut up and sit down quietly. So then at the end of the flight, when we landed in Bombay, we called the security, the airline security guys, and we waited for all the passengers to get off, and we kept these guys waiting. And then the cabin crew who were, you know, involved, they gave them a real blasting. And they made them apologize and fold their hands and, you know, whatever. So,
wow.
So yeah, that was a little interesting.
And that all happened while the plane was up in the air?
No, it actually happened on ground. So, I mean, we could have booted them off the flight, but then the crew decided not to kick them off. That was a very nice thing of them to do, because that guy had completely messed up the seat. They had to change. They actually changed the seat at the end of the flight. They removed the seat and they had to put another one because he had fucked it up so bad.
Wow. Well, I guess the question I've got is, I mean, you've been flying for a while now. Surely you would have seen lots of interesting scenarios like this over the years. I was going to ask you, with that story that you just told me, I mean, you've been flying for a few years now. You would have seen some pretty crazy things over the years.
Yeah, I've heard some stories. Being a pilot, you don't really interact with passengers much because, you know, after the whole 9/11 thing, pilots are pretty much locked in the cockpit, and, you know, if anything happens, like if there's any sort of drama or altercation in the cabin, the pilots are just supposed to sit in the cockpit and lock the door, you know. Those are the rules now. So we can't really get involved with the passengers anymore. But yeah, this was probably the first incident in a while that I can remember where I ran into some interesting people at work.
Since 9/11, with all the extra security and everything that's needed, do you feel that there's a lot of pressure put on everybody that's involved, like you and like the pilots and obviously the hostesses and everybody on the plane?
Yeah, because before all that happened, you know, flying used to be fun, you know, especially for the crew and for the pilots, because, and even for the passengers, because, you know, things like letting say kids inside the cockpit, you know, it wasn't such a big deal. You know, people used to go and visit the cockpit and, you know, look around, and you know, kids would come. And now all that is completely stopped, especially in air, you know. So like after the flight gets over, when the passengers are deplaning, you know, if there's a person who wants to see the cockpit, then, you know, we can allow them. But, you know, while the flight is going on, it's completely disallowed. Plus, for us to allow people to sit in the cockpit, that is also banned. I mean, they've banned, like, you know, if suppose a friend of mine is traveling on my flight and I want him to sit in the cockpit, that's not allowed by the rules anymore. You know, so they've become really anal about everything. But I guess that's what happens when you, you know, have crazy people turning planes into missiles.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Do you guys feel, I mean, I'm not going to try and get political, but do you guys feel, I mean, where you guys are in India, do you feel a lot of pressure with neighboring countries and just that area that's a lot closer to you than probably other parts of the world?
Not really. I mean, in India, see, the thing is, in India, we're used to people getting killed. Like just today, there was in a temple in South India, there was a firecracker explosion which killed 100 people. So we're kind of used to, you know, bombs going off and terrorist attacks. It happens, like, you know, I wouldn't say it happens very regularly, but it's been happening over the last few decades, you know. So it, I mean, you kind of you're kind of numb to all that stuff now, you know, unless it really hits you close to home. Like, in fact, the Brussels attacks that happened recently at the airport, my sister-in-law was she's also a pilot with another airline, and she was in Brussels, and she was in the hotel right opposite the airport where all the bombs exploded.
Wow.
And one of her crew, one of her cabin crew was actually injured. Two of them were actually injured in the blast, and she just got saved because she was going there a little later. And you know, so until it kind of you know, happens to someone close to you, you don't really I wouldn't say you don't really care, but it kind of happens, you know, and it's a part of life, I guess.
It's like what you said. You can be, I think, unless it is close to home, you are quite numb to it. You're desensitized to a lot of the things that you see and hear. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I guess with the Brussels thing, with you being a pilot yourself and being in that industry, it's, I mean, regardless of the family connection, it's, I guess it's, I don't know. Do you feel stressed?
In fact, not really, but you know, now, like, for instance, in the last 1 month, there have been about the airline that I work with, Air India, we've had about maybe 7 to 10 bomb threats on flights, which were all hoaxes. They're all hoaxes. But if someone calls up the airline and says that there's a bomb on this flight, you have to take it seriously, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, we've had like at least 3 or 4 instances where they've had to evacuate the aircraft because of the bomb threat. Wow. I mean, eventually they were all hoax calls. You know, but when I go to work, I don't really think about it, you know. I don't have any sort of fear or anxiety about, you know, these kind of things.
Hmm.
I guess you have to just take whatever precautions you feel are the best to do, and hope for the best, I guess.
Well, you know, I mean, you never know what will happen, will you? And you just have to. I mean, if you lived in fear, then you'd never do anything. So
yeah, you really can't live in fear, because when these kind of things happen, like even in Mumbai about, I think 5 years back, there was some really horrific terrorist attacks in the city, where, you know, these gunmen, they went around spraying bullets all over the place and killed about 200 people. You know, that whole terrorist attack went on for about 3 days. But the day after that, people just went back to work, you know, because they just had to do it. So, you know, that's how it's become, you know.
You've got no choice.
Yeah, you don't have a choice, really. Yeah.
How long have you been a pilot for?
I've been flying with this airline for about 10 years now.
And were you flying before, so that's 10 years with Air India?
Yeah. I mean, this is my first job, and I've been here ever since. So I started my training in 2005, and I joined the airline in 2006. So yeah, I've been there since then.
And what was the reason for you being a pilot? Did you always want to be a pilot, or did you sort of just fall into it, or what happened?
Well, my father was a flight engineer with Air India. Flight engineers are now extinct because, like, in the olden days, a cockpit consisted of about 4 or 5 different crew, where you had the commander, the co-pilot, you had a navigator, you had a flight engineer. But then as things got more automated and, you know, the technology improved, there was no need for navigators, and now there's no need for flight engineers. So you just have a pilot and a co-pilot in the cockpit. So he was flying with Air India, and he used to, you know, travel a lot, and he used to do a lot of international flying and stuff like that. So I was never really, when I was a kid, I was never really enthusiastic about being a pilot. I was more into music and football. Football was like my biggest craze at that time. but in India, I mean, it's kind of like the norm that you have to, you know, there's no, I mean, now it's changed, but before it was like, you have to just listen to what your parents say, and you have to study, and you have to do well in college, and you have to get a job, and blah, blah, blah. So you have to make certain choices, you know. So in India, it was primarily you either become a doctor, or you become an engineer, or you become a lawyer, or, you know, you become a pilot or something like that. And since I had that exposure to, you know, aviation, and since my dad was in that line, it seemed like a sort of a natural, you know, choice. And I went through 4 years of engineering, which was really, really frustrating because I had absolutely no interest in it, but I just did it for the fuck of it. And after that, I was like, you know, fuck this. I'm not going to do this shit anymore. And it was also because of the job scene for pilots. It goes through like cycles of high demand and, you know, absolutely no demand for several years. So the time when I graduated, there were the market had really opened up, and there were a lot of jobs for pilots. They were hiring pilots left, right, center. So because of the demand, I just made the decision to, you know, go to Texas and get my license, and that was it. I didn't look back after that, and, you know, that was probably the best decision I made.
Wow.
Regarding my career, at least.
And you went to Texas?
Yeah, I did my flight training in Texas.
Okay, well, and what was that like?
That was a lot of fun. I mean, even though I did it after 9/11, and, you know, brown people are like super profiled when they fly around in the US, and especially when you're learning how to fly over there. But it was really, it was actually a lot easier than probably if I had tried to do my training in India.
Wow, okay.
And it was a lot of fun because over there, you basically just have to have the money to pay for the plane. And once you pay them, you can take the plane wherever you want, and, you know, do your training and do your cross-country solos and stuff like that. And it's pretty good fun, you know. So it wasn't a very long period. It was about 6 months or so. But it was a good experience.
Oh, it would have been amazing. Was that, and you'd been to the US before that, hadn't you?
I mean, because by virtue of my father being in the airline, we used to get free tickets, and, you know, so we used to always go abroad for vacations every couple of years. So I'd traveled quite a bit, you know, when I was a kid also. So
yeah, that's cool. That's really cool. And with flying with Air India, have you always flown domestically within India, or do you do international flying as well?
I do international flying, but it's mostly just short haul international to say the Middle East. And I used to fly to Bangkok and Singapore. Now it's just Dubai and Abu Dhabi and stuff like that. So just a few international destinations, but most of it is like about 90% of it is domestic flying.
Okay. And I have no idea what a roster looks like for a pilot. How many hours of flying, or what do your shifts look like for a week of work?
Well, right now I'm flying really, really, like my flying is really high. I do something like four sectors in a day, which is a lot, you know. And when you do that a couple of times a week, you end up almost maxing out on the allowable hours you can fly in a week and in a month. So you got to keep a track of that. So like for instance, yesterday I did a flight to from Bombay to Jaipur, Jaipur to Bombay, then Bombay to Bangalore, and then back to Bombay. So I was out from 11 in the morning, and I came back at about 9 o'clock at night. And then the the cycles they kind of vary. Sometimes you're flying early mornings, and you have to get up at 4 o'clock, and then you have like a 10-hour duty. And sometimes they're flying during the day, sometimes they're flying at night. The entire night, especially these international flights, are mostly at night. So it's kind of a mixed bag. So
you must have a pretty
right now it's pretty hectic, because there's a lot of shortage of pilots and blah blah blah. So the flying has gone up a lot. So before, my life was a little more relaxed, but it kind of happens in cycles, basically.
It must be pretty full on for your sleeping patterns.
Generally what happens, like different people have different they have different tolerance levels for, say, morning flights or evening flights, or so I hate flying early in the morning, because even though I don't have a problem waking up, like I'm really good at waking up, because even if I have to get up at, say, 3:30 or 4 in the morning, many times I get up about 2 minutes before the alarm rings, even though I've slept just 4 or 5 hours. But then when you do an early morning, like again and again and again, like by the third day, you really don't know where you are, because, your day starts at about 4, and then you come home in the afternoon. And then if you sleep too much in the afternoon, then you don't get sleep at night. Mm-hmm. And then again, you have to wake up at, 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock or whatever. And so by the second or third day, it gets really tiring, So you got to try and, mix it around to make sure that you get, at least a couple of nights of good sleep, and, mix it around.
Do you get much notice with where you will be flying, or is it something that you only get a couple of days notice?
I mean, we're supposed to get, like, on paper we get like a monthly roster, but because of the shortage and various other exigencies, those rosters are hardly ever maintained. So you're always pulled out for flights that you're not rostered for. So. Now, like, for instance, tomorrow I had a flight in the evening at about 7 o'clock, just to Goa and back. And they called me up and asked me to do another flight before that. So again, I'm doing, 4 sectors tomorrow.
Wow.
So yeah, it's kind of a little messed up. There's a lot of changes. Sometimes 2 days ago, I had a flight in the evening, which is about a two and a half hour flight. Each way. So I did about 4.5-5 hours. And while I was coming back to Mumbai, I got a message saying that I had to go to Bangalore, to another place, because there was a flight that was stuck, and they were about to cancel it because they didn't have a pilot for it. So, and I had my cats at home who were alone, and I didn't know what to do. So, because my wife is out of town. So I had to call up my mom and make sure that she could go there and, feed them and stuff. And I had to go to Bangalore and spend the night over there and then come back the next day. So sometimes you get like no notice at all, and you just have to be prepared for it.
Wow. That's quite amusing. You've got a plane full of people that are hoping you'll be available to fly them where they need to go. And then you've got the dilemma of worrying about your cats at home and hoping that they get fed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had made plans to go out drinking and stuff after my flight, and then I had to do this other flight, and I was like, fuck.
Oh, wow. It's a very unusual job compared to most other jobs out there, because most people they work, like 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. or whatever it might be. And and for you, it's all over the place. It could be anything. And
you don't have, we don't really have any public holidays, Saturdays, Sundays. You can fly on any particular day, So, especially the thing is that most of my friends, since they have regular jobs, most people are free on the weekends. So You know, it's always my weekly endeavor to make sure that I do flights in such a way that I can, you know, go out on the weekend and, you know, play football or whatever, you know. I have to, like, manage my flights around my social schedule and my extracurricular activities to, you know, make my life worthwhile, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I think now, I'm not sure what it's like in India. I'm sure it's the same as Australia, where it's a lot cheaper to fly than it was 10 or 15 really years ago. So you probably...
Yeah, exactly.
Years ago, the weekends would have been the busiest time, but it's probably consistently busy all through the week as well now, because you've got people traveling for business and...
Yeah, exactly. So pretty much throughout... In fact, I think on the weekends, especially on Sundays, people fly less. The number of flights on a Sunday are less. But otherwise, throughout the week, it's pretty much, you know, flights are full all the time. So, because people are traveling a lot nowadays.
That's a lot easier.
And like you said, it's become a lot. Yeah, it's a lot more affordable for people to fly now. So, and India has got a massive, massive market, you know, like, the aviation market, it's been growing like something like 20% every year. So there's huge potential for air traffic over here. So things are just getting bigger and bigger. You know?
I'd wonder if there's any sky left for any more planes over India.
You'll be surprised that India isn't even the busiest place to fly in. You know, like airspace wise. I think China has probably got the most congested airspace. And of course, America is also, you know, there's so many airlines and so much of flights in and out of everywhere in the US. So there's still a long way to go. But, you know, what they're doing now is they're kind of, you know, the level of automation on both the aircrafts is so high that they are reducing the separation between the distance separation between aircrafts while they're in the air, because we're able to maintain such you know, accurate flight paths because of, you know, the advanced systems on board. So the separation distance keeps on reducing every few years, you know. So before it used to be 40, you know, 80 miles, and now it's like probably 40 miles or something like that, you know. So that's how they're dealing with, you know, more and more traffic.
Is it, and I was going to talk about turbulence in a moment, because turbulence for me freaks me out big time. I'm the worst. I used to be a really, really good flyer, and then I don't know what happened. Nothing particularly happened, but I just instantly became a nervous flyer, and every time there's a little bit of turbulence, I freak out. And a lot of that turbulence I've learned, and I'm not terribly educated in it, a lot of it comes from the winds and trade winds and whatnot. But does any of that come from other flights, other planes in the area, and if those distances are shortening?
Yeah, so there's this thing called wake turbulence, which is basically when the wing of an aircraft develops lift, you have these vortices that have like a swirling motion of air, which are developed around the tips of the wings, and they basically travel backwards. So if the bigger the aircraft is, the more you know, turbulent the vortices are. So if you're behind, you know, a huge aircraft like an Airbus 380 or a Boeing 777 or whatever, you have to maintain slightly more distance so that you're out of the wake. Because especially, you know, when you're coming into land or you're taking off, that can be quite dangerous. But basically, there are rules for, you know, a minimum amount of separation time between, you know, the time an aircraft lands and the next aircraft lands, or when an aircraft departs. You know, they basically categorize aircrafts into heavy, medium, and light categories. And there are different separation times for, you know, each of those planes.
Okay.
So as long as you maintain those separation times, you're pretty safe. So
it's more on takeoff and landing that you would experience that, more so than being up in the sky itself.
Well, I mean, there are different types of, turbulence. The wake turbulence is something that happens, it's something that you experience when you're closer to the airport, because the separation of aircrafts is much less at that point. You know, there's just about 5 miles of separation between each aircraft that's landing. Then when you're up in the air at about 35,000 feet, you have, clear air turbulence, which happens because of jet streams. You have turbulence because of weather, like if you're going into some really cloudy parts, or if you have like monsoon clouds and stuff like that also has its own turbulence. So some of it can be detected by our radars. Clear air turbulence, it's called clear air turbulence because you can't really detect that kind of turbulence. It's just kind of like invisible, and it can happen anytime. So you just need to be ready to put the seatbelts on pretty fast.
I assume you probably had a few times over the last 10 years where you've had some pretty intense turbulence.
Yeah, sure. Of course. It's kind of seasonal. Basically, during the winter months, between around December to February, March, over the northern part of the country, there's a lot of turbulence in the air, especially at the higher altitudes. So we generally try to avoid flying, higher up during those times, because they can kind of forecast. They're able to forecast that, on this route, at this altitude, you can experience. They have like numbers for the severity of the turbulence that you can experience. So if it has like a 3 or a 4 or something, sometimes you have even a 9, then you just stay out of that, that flight level, and you fly either above it or below it. Wow. So, whew. Yeah, but I've been in some situations where it's been pretty bad. Throughout the entire 2-hour flight, we've been like jumping up and down in our seats because of the turbulence. And there's nothing we could really do about it, because sometimes it's so widespread that you can't even fly like really low, because then you end up burning, a whole lot of fuel. So you just have to grin and bear it.
After 10 years of going through these scenarios over and over again, do you get nervous mm-hmm. when you have heavy turbulence, or because you know what it is, it doesn't really faze you too much?
No, yeah. I mean, when you get experience, when you gain experience, you kind of know what's coming most of the time. So you don't really get scared or anything. But yeah, there are times when it can really surprise you and can come out of nowhere. And but generally, you're kind of prepared for it. You can expect it. So
yeah, it definitely helps when you know what's going on, and you've got a little bit of control over the situation as well.
Yeah, I mean, the best rule is to just to avoid areas where you can expect turbulence, just fly around it or fly under it or over it. That's the best practice.
Oh, I would have been like that guy on the plane yesterday who drank too much. I would have been drinking too much just to avoid the nerves of potential turbulence. Oh, I'm shocking. I'm so bad now. Gripping the seat whenever the plane drops.
Actually, when I was young, I was also a horrible flyer. I used to be... I could never eat when I was on a flight. So even if I was taking like a 10-hour long flight from here to Europe or the US, I would just like curl up in my seat and go to sleep. And I'd get really airsick. And I mean, that continued until I was probably about 18 or so. And then it probably got a little better. So I was also a pretty shitty flyer in my time.
And I guess, well, not so much turbulence, but with emergency situations, have you ever been in a situation where you've had to go through an emergency procedure?
Yeah. In fact, just exactly a month back, on the 9th of last month, I had this bird that went into my engine right during the takeoff. While we were getting airborne, there was a massive kite that was right in front of us on the runway. And he got sucked into the engine. And immediately the vibration started going up, and then we started getting some oil pressure warnings and stuff, and I had to shut down the engine. So once you shut down the engine, you immediately have to declare an emergency and just come back and land. So we had to do that. And when we came back and landed, the engine was completely, like the fan blades and all were completely destroyed.
Wow.
They had to change pretty much all of those blades. So we were like stuck there for 2 days because, you know, the mechanics were working on the aircraft, and we were like, we were in a small city, we were in a small town. So we had to like stay there for 2 days until the aircraft was rectified and then bring it back.
It would have been bad for the passengers on the plane as well.
For passengers, it's pretty scary. Hmm. But that was actually the first emergency that I had in my entire career, you know.
Wow. Okay. I'm glad we spoke now.
Yeah, right at the right time. I mean, some pilots, they go through a career of 25, 30 years without having any emergencies, you know.
Yeah.
My co-pilot, the guy who was flying with me on that day, he was in his first year of flying and he had just about 200 hours of experience. And this was like his first emergency, you know, when he was fresh from training, you know.
Wow.
And it was my first emergency too, and I had been flying for 10 years. So, you know, there are no distinctions that way.
Yeah. Is it something that that you all have to go through constant training for emergency procedures, like refresher courses and things like that?
You have every 6 months you have to go to the simulator, and you know, they give you a whole bunch of exercises. That's pretty much like a dress rehearsal for, you know, the kind of thing that happened to me. But many times, you know, things happen to you in a flight which you, you know, probably can't train for exactly in the simulator, or it doesn't happen the way it happens in the simulator because, you know, the aircraft is different. You know, a simulator can only replicate, you know, 70% of what actually happens in a flight, you know. Or maybe not 70%, maybe a little bit more, but the thing is, you don't get the exact scenario like how you get it in the simulator, you know. It can happen at any time. So you have to be prepared. That's the main thing.
Can only prepare you so much for, you know, for something that may happen. But as you said, like when it actually happens, it could be very different to anything you've ever trained.
Yeah, because and when it happens, to you, no matter how good a pilot you are, for the first couple of seconds, you are stunned. You know, there's this startle factor that happens. I mean, it hits everyone basically, because suddenly you'll hear a loud noise, or there'll be like a big bell ringing, and you know, you'll suddenly wake up. And the important thing is getting yourself out of that stunned state, and then just, you know, getting your training through and following whatever the procedure is and getting it done. So that's the most important part of handling an emergency, you know.
And with what happened a few days ago with the bird flying into getting sucked into the engine, you would have had almost like a checklist of things that you had to do. As you said, you had to turn off the engine, then declare it an emergency situation. But there would have been a number of things that you've had to tick off the list to make sure that you're keeping the plane and the passengers safe.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, we practice like engine failure procedures during takeoff, you know. So there is a certain procedure, a certain sequence of things that you have to do, and you basically have to just follow the sequence. And as long as you do everything properly and you come back and land, then you're okay. You know, if you mess up the sequence and, something happens, then, you know, you could get called by the flight safety department and they'll give you a big lecture and, you know, probably ground you for a few weeks. So the main thing is you have to just follow whatever procedures you've been trained to follow, and you should be okay.
Well, it's a pretty serious job, and there's you got a lot of responsibility. So I don't think I could do it.
I mean, when things like this happen, you kind of realize how serious the job is, and you know, I mean, most of the time, it's you know, you kind of take it for granted, and you feel it's a fun job and all. But it's also got its serious moments, you know, when things like this happen. So
absolutely,
that's why, yeah, training is really important.
Yeah, definitely. And when it comes to aviation and being a pilot, do you have like, is there a goal, or are there goals that you want to achieve being a pilot or being in aviation at all? Or are you pretty much happy with where you are now and what you do?
Not really. I mean, see, for a pilot, you generally start off your career on a smaller aircraft. So you're kind of like right now I'm flying domestic routes. The biggest promotion for a pilot is basically becoming a commander. You know, that transition from being a first officer to a captain. That is like the biggest thing in your career as a pilot. So that happened to me about almost 2 years back. And then after that, you either want to go onto a bigger aircraft where you're flying, you know, international sectors, long haul flying, or on your own fleet, you go up the ladder, you become what they call a line training captain or an instructor or an examiner. Those are the ways you can kind of further your, you know, career prospects. So that's pretty much it. Once you become, you know, an examiner on your fleet, you're pretty much at the top of the food chain. But then that takes a lot of time, you know. It doesn't happen soon. Yeah. In some airlines, it happens pretty fast. In some airlines, it takes an entire lifetime. So that varies.
It's probably the longer it takes, the better, I would assume. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think if somebody gets into a position like that very quickly, then I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they've got enough experience.
Well, yeah, you do have to have a minimum, you know, amount of experience to get there. But it's basically about, you know, your competence and your ability to, you know, teach or instruct or be an examiner. That is the, you know, the main criteria, you know, your knowledge and your competence. Mm. As long as you have that, I mean, experience also counts for a lot. So it's not a good thing to discard the experience and, you know, promote people, but all of them play an important role.
Mm, absolutely. And is there a particular segment of planes that you fly, like, you know how you mentioned large, medium, and what was it like?
So I fly the Airbus 320. So that's sort of like a medium to long, not a long haul. It's like a medium haul aircraft in terms of the routes that we do. So the Airbus 320 or the Boeing 737. These aircraft, they generally do, you know, shorter sectors of, say, 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, or, you know, they can go up to like 5-6 hours also. But generally, if you're doing long haul flights, those are on bigger aircrafts like the Boeing 787 or the 777 or the Airbus 330. Those aircrafts, they do the 8 hour, 9 hour, 16 hour long flights. Right now, I'm doing the shorter sectors, but this is a really good aircraft. I mean, as an aircraft, it's a fantastic machine. I'm really happy on it, so it's nice.
Is there a particular plane that you haven't flown yet that you'd love to fly?
Well, I mean, there are thousands of planes that I haven't flown because you pretty much once you're kind of type rated on a particular aircraft, you can only fly that aircraft. Until you get rated on another aircraft. So you can't, if you're talking about like the initial training, then you can fly different aircrafts, but those are all small, you know, single engine aircrafts, or, you know, small multi-engine aircrafts. But once you transition to jet, you know, jet aircrafts like the Airbus, Boeing, then you're pretty much just flying that aircraft for several years until you get an opportunity to move on to another aircraft, you know. And then you fly that aircraft for several years, you know. So you're just flying one aircraft at a time.
Is there one though that you would like one day like to, if the opportunity came and you could train and do whatever you needed to.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I would love to fly, you know, the Airbus 350 or the 380. You know, those are the bigger aircrafts of the Airbus family. And mainly because it's just a change in the routes, the change in the lifestyle. You know, you get to see different places. The kind of flying that you do is different. You're not doing like, you know, four sectors a day. You're doing just one takeoff and one landing, and then you go to the hotel. You know, so it's pretty chilled out that way.
So it's more, as you said, the lifestyle around having that sort of that flight sector more so than the plane itself.
It's a lifestyle. It's the money. It's the plane. It's everything. I mean, there are a lot of things. The plane, I mean, transitioning from one plane to another, like especially if you're staying within, you know, the Airbus family or the Boeing family, the amount of training that you have to do is not much. Like if I'm going from one Airbus aircraft to another Airbus aircraft, the transition training is just maybe about 3 or 4 weeks. So it's not a big deal. And once you get used to that, you know, aircraft within a few months or whatever, then it's, you know, it's like flying anything else. You know? So, but I guess each plane has its own charm, you know. So yeah, I'd like to fly the bigger aircraft someday. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, in about 5-6 years, I might get a chance.
When you said each plane has its own charm, I just instantly mm-hmm. thought of like me when I play guitar, and you find a guitar and every guitar's got a slightly different just feel to it.
Right, right.
Do you notice that even if you're flying 320s, can you tell the difference between each plane, even though they're the same model? Do you sometimes feel that there's a slight, I mean, they should all be identical, you know,
Well, see, the thing is, like, so like the Airbus 320 family has got four different models.
Okay.
They have the 318, the 319, the 320, and the 321.
Okay.
So starting from the 318 is like the shortest. It has the shortest fuselage, and the 321 has got the longest fuselage. So each one of those aircrafts, they have different characteristics. They behave differently in the air. You know, like the 321 performance-wise is not as good as the 319 or the 320, but it's a nice aircraft to land. It's easier to land. The 319, it can climb like a rocket, but you know, landing it is, I mean, it's not difficult or anything, but it just has different characteristics. So you have to apply different techniques when you're flying each of those aircrafts. But if you're comparing like different 320s, they are all pretty much the same, you know, unless there's like a huge difference in the age of the aircraft. Like we have some aircrafts which are almost 25 years old. So those aircrafts that are really old, they really feel like shit compared to So you can make out the difference. It's a very stark difference in that case. But otherwise, you know, they manufacture those planes in such a way that they all have the same feel, and you know, you can't really make out much difference.
Yeah, and just on that note, with the weight of the plane, depending mm-hmm. on how many people, I mean, I assume that majority of the flights would be fairly full. But how do you compensate for the different weights of, you know, the number of passengers in the plane and the amount of luggage it's stowed and I guess the fuel and
I mean, basically, yeah, a lighter aircraft will definitely behave, you know, differently from a heavier aircraft, you know. An aircraft that is loaded more towards the aft will behave differently from an aircraft that's loaded loaded more towards the forward, you know, with regards to the center of gravity. So all those things, they make small differences, which you need to kind of compensate for during, you know, takeoff and landing. But I mean, once you take off, you know, the autopilot is on, and it pretty much does its work. Until you have to come in and land and disconnect the autopilot at, you know, 1,000 feet or 500 feet or whatever. So, you know, the main compensations are done during the takeoff and landing phase, you know, and also during taxi, like the 3-to-1, because it's a much longer aircraft, you have to be a little more careful about how you taxi the aircraft compared to the 319. You know, the clearances, the tail clearances are different. So you have to keep all those differences in mind. You know, there are like a whole bunch of figures that they call limitations. So you have to have those in your mind all the time. So when you're flying, because you can fly like a 321 and a 319 on the same day. So you need to have all those things at the back of your head when you're, you know, flying. So that you don't screw it up.
I'm on Air India's website. I'm looking at the planes now in the fleet, and I can see the 321s, like, it's really long in comparison to the 319. Yeah. So yeah, I understand what you're saying with takeoff and towing and whatnot. Yeah. Wow. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the last thing I was going to chat to you about, and I'm going off on a completely different subject, is more the connection that we've got through music. So
yeah,
I've got heaps of people that listen to the podcast. Well, that I've got heaps of different people from all different walks of life, but a lot of them are heavy metal fans. And you're a big metal fan.
Oh yeah.
So do you just tell me I've seen you at heaps of different shows over the years, like online, like I see photos of you around the world and seeing some of your favorite bands. Do you want to tell me some of your favorite bands and different festivals and places that you've been to?
I love going for live shows. I think probably the best experience I had was last year at the Metal Days Festival in Slovenia. That was like a 5-day festival, and it had like a fantastic lineup. Who was there? There was Accept, Dream Theater, Cannibal Corpse, Death Angel, Sepultura, Carcass. It was a great lineup, you know. And the whole vibe of that festival was amazing, because it was, first of all, it was quite a small festival in terms of numbers. It was limited to about 12,000 tickets. And the location of that festival was absolutely stunning, because it was right on the banks of a river, in between a valley. And, the camping site was right on the river. People were just chilling by the river and, you know, drinking their beers and then coming for the show and stuff like that. So it was a really cool place.
I've seen some photos of it, and it looks so cool. I'd love to go one day.
Yeah, it's amazing. I would definitely go there again sometime in the future. But yeah, whenever I travel, like if I go abroad on a vacation, I always look up the local metal scene and see if there's any band playing there, and try to get a hold of a show. So like just a couple of weeks back, I'd gone to the US for a vacation for a couple of weeks, and I managed to catch Cannibal Corpse on their tour with Obituary and Cryptopsy, and that was in Miami, and I caught Slayer, Carcass and Testament in San Francisco.
Nice.
So that was that was cool. Now I've seen Slayer like 3 or 4 times. I've seen Carcass like 3 times in the last 2 years, you know. So that way it's been amazing.
That's so cool. What are your favorite metal bands of all time?
Of all time, probably my go-to bands are probably Dream Theater, Nevermore. I've been a lot into death metal recently, so I've been listening to a lot of Carcass. I've been listening to a lot of Bolt Thrower, Autopsy, and I used to be a big fan of Opeth. I'm sure you remember that picture of me running in the trees.
Yes, yeah, I do. I wasn't gonna say anything, but you brought it up.
Yeah, I won't forget that. I kind of have like about 10 or 15 bands that are like my that are, I call them the blue chip bands that I kind of listen to. Paradise Lost is another one. Paradise Lost and Type O Negative.
That's cool.
So yeah, I mean, I kind of listen to a few bands from each genre. I'm not like heavily into any particular genre of metal. I like I like some of the doom. I like some death metal, some traditional heavy metal. I also really got into this band called Hell. I'm sure you must have heard of them.
Yeah.
They're really awesome. So they're one of those the traditional bands that I've been listening to a lot.
Yeah, they're really lately. Good. Really good. Really good band. Do any of the guys that you work with at Air India know that you listen to metal?
Oh yeah, because I posted all over Facebook, so everyone knows what I listen to.
Does anybody else always listen to it?
Not really. Pilots aren't the kind of people who listen to heavy metal. They're probably about maybe two or three pilots I know who listen to any sort of heavy music.
Hmm.
But I don't think I've met anyone who, any other pilot in my country who listens to like death metal and black metal and stuff like that. So it's pretty rare.
Well, I reckon internationally there'd be very few pilots out there. I mean, I could be wrong, but
Not really, actually. I would say internationally there are pilots like probably in the Western countries who listen to metal, because I've seen Bruce Dickinson is a pilot himself. And he flies around. Yeah, and so I've seen like on message boards people saying that they're Maiden fans and stuff like that. So there are a few.
Yeah, that's cool. That's awesome. Well, I'm gonna find that. I'm gonna find that Opeth picture. I'll have to dig through the archives and have a search for it. But
I think Corpus Vermis had that saved in a hard drive for a long time.
Oh, there's it.
Because when I made an appearance a couple of years back, she posted that out of nowhere, and I was like, wow.
Oh, there's a few people from that that forum back in the day who saved every single picture. And there's these vaults of pictures, and they keep, and it's a bit creepy in a way, but it's kind of funny because every once in a while these pictures that you just forgot even existed just pop up out of nowhere.
Yeah,
Oh, really? Okay. No, I thought that died a while ago. Cool.
How's the whole Aussie gang?
Yeah, good.
Are you still in touch with guys like Turner and William and
Stephen, Stan, Dale.
Just for information, I don't know any of their real names. I only know their metal rules handles.
I was going to say, you said, that's right, you said Turner. I remember that was his username.
exactly.
It was Demoniac. That was Stephen.
Okay,
so I was actually talking to him tonight. And Stan was, Stan Lupulopoulos or something. I've got no idea. Actually, that's probably his normal name because he's Greek. Sorry, Stan, if you're listening. Dale was Sui. And then Will changed his name every 6 months.
So Suicider.
Yeah. Oh, Suicider's right, Craig as well. Yeah. So, and I see Craig.
I think I met him in Singapore.
Yeah. Yep,
I met him in Singapore at a Judas Priest concert, if I remember correctly.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That was him, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're all still floating around. I was in New York last year and met up with a few people, and I saw, I can't remember his name, at Prog Power in Atlanta.
Okay.
I can't remember his username now. Off the top of my head, his name's Scott. Okay. I can't remember his username, but everyone's still floating around. They pop up in the weirdest places, and it's like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
10, 15 years ago, 16 years ago. It's just it's a long time has passed. Yeah,
yeah. That was a time when I had absolutely nothing to do in life, and no wife, and no responsibilities. So I had like all the time to be a post whore.
Same with the rest of us. We're all the same.
Well, now it's kind of shifted onto Facebook. So
yeah, that's right. We can all post stupid stuff on there now.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Well, I'll let you go. Thank you so much for
great.
For having a chat. And
it was great talking to you.
Yeah, absolutely. After all these years.
Yeah, finally.
Yeah.
I believe you're good pals with Riju Dasgupta and the guys at Albatross.
Yeah. They came over a few years ago, I looked after
them.
Yeah,
I remember that. They're a fantastic band. Yeah. They're probably my favorite band in India.
Yeah, right. Wow, cool. Yeah, they're a great band.
They're really good.
I put Riju has been on this podcast as well in the past. I did an episode with him. It was it was a lot of fun. But the funny thing with the metal scene in India is I think I'm connected to half of the entire Indian metal scene on Facebook. I've over the last few years keep talking to people, and more people message me and send me friend requests. It's like, oh, okay. I sent over a box of CDs a few times just to hand out free CDs, and then all these people keep contacting me. So it's really cool. So hopefully we can come over and play one day.
Yeah, that'll be great. That'll be amazing.
We'll have a beer.
We'll get drunk. We won't have a beer. We'll get drunk.
That's what I want to hear. and then well, maybe before we get drunk, you can be the one that flies us all across India. you can be our Bruce Dickinson.
I don't think I'll be able to fly, but I'll probably drive.
Fair enough. Oh, cool. All right, man. Well, I'll take care, and we'll chat soon.
Yeah, you too.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you so much for listening to the episode. If you enjoyed that one, definitely reach out to Arjun, and I'll have links on the show notes at andysocial.net. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, every other social media platform out there probably. I'm so easy to find. If you have trouble, then there's probably something wrong with you. In fact, I don't even know how you got to listen to this episode if you couldn't work that out. So anyway, lots of cool things that we talked about in the episode. I'm going to put a whole bunch of links on the website, and definitely reach out to Arjun if you enjoyed what he had to say. And very cool to see that a metalhead's cruising across the skies, keeping everybody safe as well. It's kind of cool to know. A little bit of housekeeping before we wrap up, as I always do. If you're listening on iTunes via the podcast app or just via the iTunes desktop program, whatever the hell it's called, get on there and give me some ratings and reviews. You don't have to write War and Peace. You can just write one word or one sentence or whatever the hell you want. Give me a rating out of 5 stars. Hopefully it's 5. If it's less, then whatever. I don't really care. Just I think the interaction will help with those mysterious algorithms that iTunes use in the background. The more interaction I get, then the more people will listen to it and the more guests I can bring to you guys as well. If you aren't listening on iTunes, you're using Android or another device or whatever the hell you're using, any way of sharing the episodes will be greatly, greatly appreciated. If you're listening via YouTube, leave some comments on the videos. I don't see any comments on there at the moment, so get on there and leave some comments and let me know what you think of it all. Get some discussion happening, maybe a bit of internet arguing, whatever you can do to boost up the activity on those videos. And the YouTube videos, as I've said before, are a great way of passing the episodes on to other people. YouTube seems to be a very familiar platform for majority of people out there. So it could be a great tool to use to break people into the podcast world. That's all there. If you're not sure where everything is, you can go to andysocial.net. I've actually just updated the contact details on there, which has got all the links to different platforms and resources, so you can go there and find what you need to find. Lastly, May 28th is the podcast party, aka the Andy Social Social. It's Saturday, May 28th, starts at 6 p.m. It's at the Fun Room at Frankie's Pizza. which is in Sydney's CBD, right dead center in town, right near the actually, where is it? It's up towards the Harbour Bridge end of the city. So if you need to find out where it is, you can get in contact with me or use that fancy tool called Google. If you want to know a bit more about the venue itself and the mastermind behind the beer and the entertainment there, listen to episode 32 of the podcast, which features Jordan McDonald, who is a legend and has been very generous to allow me to have the Fun Room, which is a private little whiskey bar. And we'll have that for a few hours before it's open to the public. So 6 p.m., May 28th, Saturday, May 28th, come along. I'm only advertising it through these episodes, nowhere else. So, you know, you can tell your mum if you want to, bring her along or whoever you want, but I'm not telling anybody else. So would love to have a beer with you, love to have a drink. Come along, let's have a chat and have a great time. All right, that's about it. The episodes are ramping up like crazy. I have a plan in place and I don't even know what episode this will be, but I've got a feeling that it won't quite be the episode that I am aiming for. Well, it definitely isn't, but we're getting closer and closer to what I'm aiming for. So you'll notice that the episodes are coming in thick and fast at the moment. So thank you so much. Please keep sharing them around. Let's keep building the listener base. There's heaps of you guys out there. And it just keeps getting bigger and better. And it's just so cool. So anyway, enough rambling on. Thanks, guys, and speak to you soon.